Welcome to Radio Sefarad's English Corner. I'm your host, Linda Jimenez, bringing news and other features of Jewish interest to Radio Sefarad's English-speaking audience in Spain and around the world. Our trivia question for this week is, how was Jewish culture viewed by the surrounding non-Jewish Polish society in pre-war Warsaw? Dr. Karolina Szymaniak has a PhD in Literary and Cultural Studies. She's assistant professor at the Jewish Historical Institute in Warsaw, Poland, where she heads the Yiddish Culture Unit, and is a member of the Jewish Studies Department at the Wroclaw University. She's a researcher, editor, translator from Yiddish and English, and a language instructor. Her research interests range across modern Jewish literatures and cultures, Polish-Jewish literary and cultural relations, the politics of memory, theories of modernism and of the avant-garde, women's literature, and translation studies. In addition to having taught Yiddish language and culture throughout Poland and Europe, she served as a consultant for the Museum of the History of Polish Jews. She was the editor-in-chief of Zwischen, a Polish language, literary, and arts quarterly devoted to Yiddish culture. From 2010 to 2012, she was director of the Center for Yiddish Culture, where she now serves as an academic advisor, and the director of the International Summer Seminar in Yiddish Language and Culture in Warsaw. Dr. Szymaniak has participated in the full edition of the Ringelblum Archive, translating texts of Yiddish writers, and collaborated in the project of the database of the Warsaw Ghetto run by the Polish Center for Holocaust Research. She's been invited to give talks in France, Sweden, Australia, Poland, Canada, Ukraine, and the United States, and has received fellowships from a number of institutions, including the Polish Ministry of Education, the YIWO Institute for Jewish Research, and the Institute for the History of Polish Jewry and Israel-Polish Relations, Tel Aviv University, among others. Dr. Szymaniak spoke with us about Yiddish and Jewish culture in pre-war Warsaw and the relationship between the Jewish and non-Jewish communities there. Thank you very much for speaking with us today, Karolina. You are from Poland and you are in Warsaw with the Yiddish program there. Could you tell us about Yiddish in Warsaw before the war?
Well, Yiddish was the second language of the city, so one-third of the Warsaw population spoke Yiddish, which means that if you imagine today, I mean, if you think about Warsaw today, which is not, I mean, it's a capital city, so it's not monolingual, but it's very different from what it was before the war. So you had a really 300,000 people who spoke Yiddish in the city, and a whole parts of the city that were basically Yiddish speaking. And Warsaw was the capital, or one of the capitals of the Yiddish land. Well, Yiddish land is this kind of a very weird territorial or anti-territorial territory where you have many capitals. And it was an important center for the modern Yiddish culture and for traditional Yiddish culture, an important cultural intellectual center. And what is fascinating also is how the language worked in the space of the city. So where there were places where you would only hear Yiddish, there were places where Yiddish mixed with Polish, and the very same people who spoke Yiddish in the places entering the non-Jewish parts of the city, or the parts of the city were more assimilated, or as we say today, acculturated Jews lived, they would switch to Polish. So, and this linguistic and spatial phenomenon is very well described by different Jewish intellectuals, including, for example, Bernard Singer or Shmuel Leib Schneiderman.
Had this been going on for a very long time? Had Warsaw been a big center for Yiddish culture, or was this something that was fairly recent of people who spoke Yiddish who moved to Warsaw from outlying areas.
Yeah. Before modern times, the city had the so-called privilege, the non-tolerantis Judei, so Jews were not allowed to live in the city. They were settling on the outskirts of the city. Hence today what we call one of the main arteries of the contemporary Warsaw is called Jerusalem Alley, which comes from a settlement that was near Warsaw that was called New Jerusalem. And today it's, so the street that that starts there is the one of the main streets in Warsaw. So it's not a very centuries-old phenomenon, but then the law changed. And since 1910, I mean, it's the change of the law, it's the partitions of Poland as well, and then also the when it comes to modern Yiddish culture, the center of the culture moved from in the east to Warsaw in the late 19th century. One of the reasons, I mean, there were different reasons. One of the reasons was printing and possibilities of printing. The other was more symbolic. It was several important intellectuals who moved to Warsaw at that time, most notably Jutlamet Peretz, who moved to Warsaw from Zamość, so his home city, where he could not practice any more law because of a hoax that happened there, and he was accused, falsely accused, and who could not practice law there. And he came to Warsaw and started working at the Jewish community at the Kehila in Warsaw, and also started his cultural and literary work in the city. And he was really a magnet that was really drawing a younger generation of intellectuals to Warsaw.
So could you tell us about Yiddish life in Warsaw, in the streets, the normal people, as well as Yiddish cultural life?
It's hard to talk about. I mean, like...
On one foot.
On one foot, exactly. To be at the Hillel of Yiddish Warsaw, I'm not sure if I can be this. It's hard to think. I mean, it was a normal city life, just in Yiddish, so it's hard to say how, if there was anything different. You have to also, I mean, imagine a very lively city with this usual metropolitan hustle and bustle. Well, the Jewish quarter was also a place where... Well, there were a lot of small stores and marketplaces, so and people from all over the Warsaw would come there to buy things cheaper. The spatial structure maybe is also interesting with those deep, what we call durchev, so the courtyards that would just form small streets, actually, where you would enter as a whole universe, as it was with Nalevkis. So Yiddish was just the language of the street that you would hear everywhere. On this Jewish street, which is also an idiomatic expression, both in Yiddish and today in the Jewish English, I guess. So in this Yiddish-speaking world, just you would do anything you do otherwise. Go to school, chat with friends, sell things. What is characteristic maybe for Warsaw, and this is maybe something that is worth mentioning. So Yiddish, Warsaw Yiddish is different from, not only from the standard Yiddish, which is pretty obvious, but from the Polish Yiddish as well, so from the central dialect spoken in Poland. There is a specific Warsaw dialect, which is very beautiful and very interesting. It is well documented. There is a volume documenting this language written by Eva Geller, and in German it's called Warschauer Yiddish. So this is maybe this one, and otherwise cafes, restaurants, cinemas, stores, the religious life and the secular life that mingled there.
Now, if there was as you say, a whole Jewish society there that spoke Yiddish, was there also separately a Polish society and a Polish, let's say, neighborhoods that kind of were separated, that had really nothing culturally or socially to do with the Jews?
I mean, there was no ghetto in Warsaw. It's just, there were certain demographic tendencies, so there The Jews in Warsaw lived in the northern part of the city mostly, but doesn't mean, and this is a stereotype, that there were no Jews in other parts of the city. And it doesn't mean that Poles, non-Jewish Poles, did not live in the Jewish part of the city. So there were churches, there were non-Jewish Poles who lived there also. And so these two communities would intermingle to a certain extent. But when it comes, for example, to intellectual life, which is a very interesting thing, so Poles would not usually not look for like entertainment or intellectual, you know, events in the Jewish part of the city. We know that some went to the Jewish theater, which was considered as something exotic, fascinating, mysterious. So there is this very sad, actually, for me, anecdote that one of the major theater and literary critics of the time, and also a very important translator of the French literature into Polish, and a very progressive leftist intellectual, he was invited by Michal Weichert. Weichert was a theater critic and theoretician, and he established one of the most interesting avant-garde theaters in Warsaw. And he invited this Polish critic, whose name was Żeleński, Boy Żeleński, and to their performance of Shakespeare, and the Tempest. That's what you say in English. Yeah, Der Sturm in Yiddish. So, the Tempest. And Żeleński answered, well, if it's not something of yours, meaning like something Jewish, something exotic, something like a D-book, I'm actually not interested. So if I, you know, so he wasn't looking actually for a good theater, which it was. He was looking for, you know, this kind of exotic excitement. So for many Poles, this Jewish space of Warsaw was what one of the also leftist progressive Polish critics called a dark continent. Actually, also this notion to describe Eastern European Jewish space was used also by none other than Szymon Dubnow at a certain moment. So it's also coming from the Jewish intelligentsia. But here, this, you know, imagining this or remapping this space as a dark continent, as a sort of kind of semi-barbarian exotic space is very telling. I mean, tells you how the two communities, not on a very personal level, but on a really social level, interacted together.
Well, because I assume that these very same people would see Shakespeare translated into Polish.
Yeah, of course, but this was a really an exquisite modernist theater. And actually, this very director that I mentioned, Weichert, he organized in Warsaw the first simultaneous theater, which was at that time really a novelty in the theater performances. And then he was asked by his Polish colleagues, because there were, I mean, of course, on a personal level, as I told you, there were moments of interaction and a very interesting cooperation, which happened actually with between avant-garde artists in Warsaw, not only in Warsaw. But I was talking about a community attitude and trying to theorize that. So Weichert was invited by those Polish theater people to help them establish the Polish simultaneous theater. So it tells you how paradoxical it is. It's paradoxical to think about this, that they thought about the space as a kind of reservation. And on the other hand, there was a culture, a whole culture coming from there that really few Poles were aware of and were actually interested in.
But I'm sure that the Jewish community was aware of how rich their own culture was.
Yeah, of course they were, and Warsaw was also the capital city, so it had this kind of allure of a capital city that capital cities usually have. So many people from different parts of the country or even from abroad would come and just to be in, because it offered more opportunities when it comes to work, simply, though then after the crisis and throughout the crisis, it was much harder. It was a dazzling metropolis. For a time, really, as David Katz put it, Warsaw was the metropolis with satellites in Berlin and in Paris. Which also, you know, if you, so I'm just trying to think, like, if we think about the history of the city from the Jewish perspective, it's much more, sometimes it seems much more exciting than if you just tell it from this kind of, you know, monocultural perspective, which I think we only now learn to appreciate. Of course, so people kept coming. On the one hand, it was a transit city for many migrants. On the other hand, it was a the destination for many intellectuals, but also for people who are just looking for work and who wanted to be in a place that offered more economic opportunities.
What kind of relationship did the Jewish community and the non-Jewish community have, aside from what you mentioned about how people went to the Jewish shops to buy things cheaper? Was there any kind of social interaction, not necessarily on an intellectual level, but on a normal street level?
Well, on a normal street level, of course. I mean, different moments, so people would just go, I know.
They were friends.
I mean, or just, you know, not even to buy things, but, for example, to visit an interesting photographer to take, you know, to have their pictures taken, or many other. So this, on personal level, it's much more a much more complicated situation than on a community level, and which is obviously harder to tell as well, because you need individual examples to use as an illustration for these. But there were schools, that children attended, and also very important, like this kind of contact zone between Polish and Jewish societies were public schools, which also comes with another problem we have in the interwar Poland, which is after the First World War, Poland, along with other new countries, I mean new or reborn countries of the region, signed the so-called Minority Treaty, which obliged them, for example, to provide state-sponsored education in minority languages, among other things. I'm simplifying here. And school was a powerful tool for Polonization, which was the agenda of the state. So the state wanted to Polonize the Jewish society and wanted them to use Polish and to embrace Polish culture as the only culture and not as one of their cultures, which was in fact with different individuals, not with the Jewish community as a whole, at large. At school that was free of charge with no fees and that was using Polish as the main instruction language was a powerful tool to achieve this goal. And actually we see this in the 1930s. If you consider the autobiographical contest that the YIVO Institute organized in the 1930s with Max Weinreich and his whole idea of Jugendforschung, you see that so many, even kids coming from very traditional families, Hasidic families, Polish culture is part of their culture already, and how deep the processes of acculturation are. So it was a success in this respect. On the other hand, it really diminished the role of Yiddish, for example, Yiddish schools or schools with Yiddish as a language or the language of instruction. Actually, it always had to be a language because topics as Polish history, Polish language, Polish geography had to be taught in Polish anyway, even in a school with Yiddish as the instruction language. So simply because you had to pay fees, and many parents who were sending their children to these schools could not really afford that. So schools were struggling with problems, money problems. They couldn't pay their teachers and so on and so on. And for some families that could not really afford that and were not ideologically convinced that it makes sense to send their children to Yiddish schools or Hebrew schools for that matter that also existed in Poland, they just simply would send their children to the public schools. And hence we see very deep processes and also generational changes in patterns of cultural consumption, in interest in literature and culture as such, and in the languages spoken.
Well, and I imagine that the poorest families who had to send their children to the public schools probably had less contact with the cultural movements anyway. Just because they were poor and they probably work most of the time?
Well, it's complicated. So, I mean, now we enter a very delicate issue of like kind of patronizing the excluded, which I wouldn't like to do. So there were different potters in these families, and there actually we do have a lot of research and oral history material about, for example, children who learned in these schools and coming from very poor families, and how actually the parents wanted to invest in a better future of them and just offered what the culture had to, and wanted them to enjoy what the culture had to offer. Even so, the interest was there, and sometimes it was immense. Here we have one of the participants in this seminar. We were talking about translations of philosophy and world literature, the so-called world literature, into Yiddish, and he mentioned that his father, who was a worker, he wanted to read Spinoza in Yiddish. He wanted to. There was this kind of need, and I think that we cannot underestimate this interest just because of the financial or economic exclusion that these families were suffering.
So tell us about the relationship between the two languages, because that was very interesting, and you had mentioned in the talk that you gave how there were a lot of Yiddish words that ended up being used in Polish and still are today. Can you speak a little bit about the relationship before the war and what happened afterwards?
I'll do that, but I have to mention one more thing, which I did not mention in my previous answer. Also, there is a kind of pattern that you can discern in, so for example, richer families usually also were more acculturated. So this is also, the interest for Yiddish culture, diverse, low and, popular and high modernist Yiddish culture came actually from, mostly from less well-off families, which is also, you have to be careful with this. It does not mean that, Yiddish was only supported by poorer families, but there is a certain sociological and demographic pattern that you can analyze. And there is also this belief of Yiddish intellectuals, which is part of a cliché too, that, the massen, the horepashne massen, so the toiling, how do you say, toiling masses, worker yeah. masses, well, that they are the salt of the earth. So they are the salt of the Yiddish land's earth. Well, that's something that needs to be discussed more from a more diverse perspective. I just want to mention this pattern too, because this was a problem, a major problem for the Yiddishist project. So how to keep different strata of society within the realm of Yiddish culture, how not to let the intelligentsia go, for example, just to ausleben sich, as we say in Yiddish, so just to, just realize their own needs and fulfill their own needs in other language cultures. So this is a major problem and a discussion, and one of the reasons of the failure of the Yiddishist project, because one thing that we need to consider is the Holocaust and the major loss of Yiddish speakers, because among the victims of the Holocaust were mostly Yiddish-speaking Jews, not only, obviously, but the language and the culture suffered a major loss. But if we think about patterns of development of Yiddish culture in America, we see that these processes were also very advanced, and Yiddish culture in the fairly favorable, let's say, it's not favorable conditions, but did not thrive there. And the acculturation prevailed. So coming back to the relationships between Polish and Yiddish languages, well, it's a very complex question and I'm not a linguist, and I can try to answer it from a cultural historian perspective and say a little bit about linguistic problems too. So these languages were for centuries they were in an intensive, very close and very deep contact. And this linguistic and cultural contact resulted in very interesting phenomena that we can observe within both Yiddish and Polish language and culture. And culture here meaning, from the kitchen to the literature, okay? So cuisine too. When you think about the languages, so first of all, I don't want to enter a very long and very heated discussion that is ongoing between linguists, how to classify Yiddish and what is really more important, the paradigmatic or the syntagmatic, structure of the language, but it is a highly Slavicized language in its deeper structure, not only in the obvious loan words or structures that are easily recognized as Slavic. It is much deeper, and it considers the way we structure thought in Yiddish, and then we express ideas in Yiddish too. So this is one thing. And obviously in Yiddish you have a large number of Slavic loanwords, not only from Polish, but from other Slavic languages. Sometimes it's very easy to trace the history of a given word because of a phonetic structure and the changes that we can simply study. Sometimes it's more complicated. It's not as it is commonly, popularly believed, only words that deal with the everyday life, nature, considered not such a Jewish thing, which is also a stereotype. And the kind of words that are considered less noble or less sophisticated. This is important. There is this kind of framing of the Slavic element in Yiddish that says that it's lower. It's a lower language. So if you want to be more sophisticated, you would speak more Germanic that's 19th century, late 19th century, or more Hebrew and the Aramaic words. So that's, there is this stylistic differentiation. But what is important is this kind of contact, and it resulted also in many loan words and idioms, sayings, proverbs that entered the Polish language as well, which were plenty in the interwar period. And now what is left in the today contemporary Polish, it's much less, which tells you that this intensive contact stopped, and that only a part of this vocabulary and part of this heritage, language heritage, linguistic heritage, stayed in the language, whereas much more was lost because of the loss of the Yiddish-speaking community. And many people are not aware that such words as bachor, which is a spoiled kid in Polish, or fanaberia, which is just, a wild idea, or such words as tzimes, which is a very tasty thing in Yiddish, or machloika, which actually is not such a noble thing, which is a dishonest business or a hoax, or din teure, which is actually is used in the underground and in the thieves' language, so which means actually really the kind of thieves' court. expression developed. And having said this, many words that entered Polish through Yiddish are of Hebrew and Aramaic origin because they were used as a secret language by the thieves and by the lawless. Okay, so they were used in this context, so the police could not understand. Police would be more. The policemen. Polish-speaking policemen could understand some Yiddish when it was when the Germanic and Slavic element was used, but less so when the Hebrew and Aramaic component was used. So that's hence we have really a lot of words in Polish. A lot, relatively many words in Polish that have this kind of origin. But what is interesting. People do not realize this, that this is actually such common words, because bachor, for example, so the spoiled kid, is really a word that everybody knows, and nobody knows its origin. Kapote, belfer, you know, like serdak, wapserdak, I want to say wapserdak. Many words that we just use on every day, on an everyday basis. We just don't know what we're speaking. And I like to, sometimes I teach in high school, have this kind of workshops to sensitize the students to this kind of multicultural, multilingual heritage of Poland. And they're very happy to discover both. So the heritage in their own language, and also to discover how they can understand Yiddish, knowing Polish. So I obviously pick those up words and phrases that they would understand anyway. And I tell them that this is not what the language is about, and that this is an independent, very rich language and culture. But to have this kind of, you know, entry point that can get them interested in just discovering more and more, I think it's very important. So language can be a tool to achieve this.
Thank you very much. Well, that's it for this week. As always, we'd love to hear from you. So please email us any comments or suggestions or questions you'd like us to answer on the air. Our address is englishcorner@radiosefarad.com. See you next week.